Hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. Court apologizes for being late, but we were held up in conference unexpectedly. But we arrived in time to welcome some students. Are you from New Hope Christian? Good. Would you stand, please, so the court can see you and greet you? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. The court has a program with the State Bar of Wisconsin inviting students from around the state to come join us for an oral argument. They're sent briefs of the case and have materials and do as they see fit to prepare for this oral argument. And then immediately after the oral argument today, the group will meet with Justice Rogensack to discuss the procedures of the court. Everyone is welcome to join them. There will be no discussion of the substance of the case we are about to hear. Let me introduce the justices to you all. Starting on my far left is Justice Lewis Butler. Seated next to him is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcoxon. To his right, Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far right, Justice Patience Rogensack. With those introductions made, I will call our case for today, 048P1305 and 1306, Brown County versus Shannon R. Arguing on behalf of Shannon R. is Brian C. Finley, Assistant State Public Defender. Mr. Finley, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Brian Finley on behalf of Shannon R. I would like to address the issues in this case in three parts. First, I'd like to discuss the congestion competency issue. And I think if you decide that, then we don't need to proceed. Although I'm sure we will. The second one is I'd like to address the Indian Child Welfare Act cases, the ICWA cases. And finally, I'd like to address the admission of Shannon's expert testimony. Before I begin, I'd like to point out that this case is not, as in DSP, the case I'm asking you to distinguish, as opposed to DSP, a close call. In DSP, as you remember, the parents had had no contact with the child for over a year, and there was simply no contested evidence. In this case, on the other hand, the court set a disposition. There's no question that Shannon loves her children, and there's no question here about abuse or neglect or danger. And I think that makes it a very different case.
But then what is it about?
Okay, I'll get to the facts then.
Why are these two children put in chips? One, I think, almost immediately after birth, if I remember the timeline.
These children were put in the chips because Shannon had a previous child die in her care. And so that's why they were placed in the chips. But you must understand at the same time that Shannon was 22 at the time of trial. And she was considerably younger. She was still a juvenile at the time. I think she may have still been a juvenile at the time that happened. So I don't think that's really the question that the jury was asked to decide, and I don't think that's the question that this court is asked to decide. This case is going to affect a lot of Indian Child Welfare Act cases all across the state and conceivably around the country because DSP is widely cited. So I'm asking you to distinguish DSP. The first issue I'd like to talk about is the competency in court congestion case. It's clear that what we're discussing, the reason the judge referred this case for reassignment was because of court congestion. That's what the judicial reassignment sheet said, and that's what the court said in court. In fact, the judicial reassignment form, the judge also checked another box that says other, cannot schedule within reasonable time given statutory time limits. So this is about congestion. That's important because congestion is not a valid reason for excluding the time limits. And if you don't exclude the time limits here, then the court did lose competency.
So why isn't it valid?
Well, okay, I think you have to look at the comparison with 938.315 and 48.315.
I mean, in the real world, understanding the statutes and the demands on a trial court.
Well, the legislature has intended that the time limits in TPR cases are real deadlines. Termination is an awesome power. It requires proof, facts, and procedures to show that the power is justly exercised. And this court recently said in DSS versus Sheboygan DSS versus Matthew S. and Rachel B., the time limits between critical stages within the adjudication process are necessary to protect the due process rights of children and parents.
And you were talking about the difference between a 938 section and a 48 section, I think. What are those sites?
Well, 938.315(1)(1)(dm) in the Juvenile Justice Code excludes delay caused by court congestion or scheduling. 938.315 generally and 48.315 are very similar, word for word in places. The fact that the legislature did not include a similar statute in 48.315 means that they did not intend for congestion to be a valid reason for excluding delay in TPR cases. I think that's very important. We need to look at that. Once competence is lost, the case needs to be reversed. And what happened here was congestion. It was not a judicial disqualification. If you look at judicial disqualification in the statutes, it is only defined one place that I can find, that's 757.19. And there it's clear that disqualification is a term of art that applies when there's a conflict of interest or when the judge determines that it cannot, or it appears he or she cannot, act in an impartial manner.
Counselor, we're talking about delay and the effect on due process rights of delay. Why should we consider your argument relevant? The delay is the same whether it is because the judge's daughter is the lawyer in the case, so she recuses herself, or whether there's a scheduling problem and the judge knows there are short time limits and absolutely cannot physically get the job done. So the delay is the same. Why should we be concerned about whether it's for a reason, like I said, disqualification because your child happens to be involved in the case, or a scheduling and a change in judge because of inability to perform under the statute?
The law is designed to ensure that these hearings happen timely.
Right, but the timeliness is the same, regardless of the reason for delay.
Yeah, but the statutes explain when delay is excluded, when it's told. And it cannot be told for congestion.
What are you going to do if the judges can't have the hearing then? Do you want the judges then to work until midnight, just they have to have it? They keep the courts open until midnight?
Well, I think one thing they could do is that they could, as in April O and as agreed to in Sheboygan DSS versus Rachel B., which I'll call Rachel B. from now on, they can hold a hearing in open court at which they grant a continuance for good cause. That didn't happen here.
How can it be good cause if the good cause, you're telling us good cause can't be congestion, unless I misunderstood what you said?
I don't think that this court has ever decided that whether it could or could not be. But the point is that the legislature, that congestion by statute cannot be good cause. Now, whether the court could conclude under different facts or whatever, I think that's a different thing.
But the statute is the good cause statute. It's the statute. that says good cause and considering the wishes of the DA and the parent.
Right. So I'm sorry, I don't know which statute that is.
483152.
Yeah, I mean, this Court has been very clear in allowing continuances if the parties agree to it.
That requires open court and on the record.
That's correct.
Is there any continuance here on the open record?
No.
That
never happened.
Okay.
That never happened.
There was no fulfillment of the requirements of 3.2.
Going back to
Mr. Finley.
Yes, sir.
Trying to understand the facts here. We have two kids.
Right.
And the first young child, where there was a petition, that was within the right time period?
Daniel is the younger child. His petition was filed first, and his initial appearance occurred back in June of 2003. So it already happened. And I think that's a good point to talk about the other reason the county has talked about for tolling the time limits is because of consolidation.
I follow up here. In the second child, there's a petition, and that's in early September, I believe.
September 2nd.
Okay. And so the issue in this case on the time period is the 30 days after the petition that was filed in September. Is that right?
September 2nd, right.
Okay. Now, shortly after the petition was filed in September, didn't the county move to consolidate the two cases?
Yes, they moved to consolidate, and the court granted the order to consolidate on September 26th.
Okay, so
although that order was not actually entered until October 2nd.
Okay, so that if a petition was filed on September 2nd and a motion to consolidate was filed on September 4th or something like that, and it was granted later in the month, isn't that a pre-trial or pre-hearing motion? And doesn't that consume time? And isn't that time recognized as something that should not be counted?
Wisconsin Statute 48.315 sub 1 sub G, it discusses continuances. And it says it excludes a reasonable period of delay when the child is joined in a hearing with another child as to whom the time for a hearing has not expired. Well, in this case, Daryl's case was joined to Daniel's case, the time had already expired. By its direct terms, 48.315 sub 1 sub G does not apply.
Well, I direct your attention to 48.315.1A, pre-hearing motion.
Okay, but that's never been argued by the state, and I think the more specific statute applies here.
Well, in the best interest of the child, shouldn't we at least consider that?
The best interests of the child do not apply until there has already been a finding that the parent is unfit.
The best interests of the child always come into consideration. It may be that they don't dominate the way they dominate in other periods, but there aren't any periods where the best interests of the child are just irrelevant, to the best of my knowledge.
Well, take a look at, I believe it's Julie A.B., but it basically says that until a finding of unfitness has occurred, the parents' rights to raise their parents are of equal importance. It's only after there's been a finding of unfitness that the best interest of the child standard applies. At this point, there's been no finding of unfitness. We can all argue about that, but my real point is that the specific statute here, which the county has relied on, doesn't apply. And I don't think that there was any reasonable delay. In my brief, I said maybe several days were a reasonable delay, but what happened was Daniel had already received his initial appearance. They moved to join Daryl's case, and it shouldn't have slowed things down one bit, because Daniel, the statute on consolidation only extends when you join the case with a slower moving case, and that's not what happened here.
Counsel?
Yeah.
I want to look at that statute and the interpretation of 1G, which you are now advancing. It reads, a reasonable period of delay, so that there's flexibility in that, how you define reasonable. When the child is joined, and the child here we're talking about is Daryl.
That's right, the older child.
Yeah. When Daryl is joined in a hearing with another child, Daniel, as to whom the time for a hearing has not expired. I know that Daryl apparently had his initial appearance. What was the time frame with regard to, the child Daniel had already had his initial appearance. What was the time frame with regard to Daniel's initial appearance, and had the time not expired?
The petition in Daniel's case was filed on May 27, 2003, so the time for the initial appearance expired 1 month after that. It expired in June, and his initial appearance was held June 16, 2003.
What does the phrase, as to whom the time for a hearing has not expired, you are interpreting that to mean a slower moving case. That was what you argued. Why does it mean that as opposed to a case where the time requirements have indeed been satisfactorily met pursuant to statute?
I'm sorry, I don't quite understand the question.
You're interpreting as to whom the time for a hearing has not expired. Interpreting that to mean it's referring to a slower moving case.
I think in this case the time for the hearing, which hasn't expired, would be the same hearing that's pending in Daryl's case or the initial appearance. The statute talks about tolling time limits. It talks about tolling time limits when there's a reason for the delay. And obviously, if you join this case to a slower moving case, then that's a reasonable delay caused by the joinder. But when you join this case to a case that's already had the initial appearance, there's no reason why the rule in 48.22 requiring an initial appearance within 30 days should still apply.
Was there some discovery issues that slowed the progress of Daniel's case?
Yes, they were interested in whether the tribe was going to take a position. Yeah. But the initial appearance had happened. That has no bearing or relevance, in my opinion, to whether or not they should hold the initial appearance in Daryl's case timely. I'd like to move on to the Indian Child Welfare Act cases, because I'm really running out of time. I want to...
This isn't the race.
Oh, okay.
Just
right, well, if you still got more questions, please let me know. Okay. After thinking about the remedy I asked in, I believe my analysis is correct on the Indian Child Welfare Act issues, but I believe that the remedy I requested is wrong. After looking at it and saying, well, the higher burden of proof, reasonable doubt, should apply, I believe that's correct. But I believe that all of the federal law should apply, and that therefore it is error to give instructions on the state law. The reason for that is that ICWA provides that the higher standard of a protection shall apply whenever it's the state or the federal standard. And in this case, the higher standard of protection is the federal law. It's got a higher burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. It has no time limits in which the parent can meet the conditions for return, and active efforts is a higher standard than reasonable efforts. For example, if a parent is in prison, reasonable efforts may not require efforts, but active efforts does. And there are other states that have found that active efforts is a higher standard. So I'm sorry, but I believe that the appropriate relief here is to apply the federal law and not apply the state law at all. And it was very confusing. Because the jury was asked to decide basically the same thing under two different standards.
Well, when you say apply these federal law versus the state law, do you apply, what law do you apply on the grounds for termination?
Well, the grounds for termination would be, did Brown County try to make active efforts to prevent the breakup of the Indian family?
That's the federal law.
That's the federal law. And did the effort of the county or the tribe to provide remedial services or rehabilitative programs prove unsuccessful? And then also the serious damage or physical harm. So I would say that because the federal law applies a higher standard, we should apply that.
Counselor, in the special verdict, are you telling us then that the questions were wrong that were asked in the special verdict?
That's correct. I think that what I'm asking this court to do is say that they should apply only the federal law.
Not only were the questions wrong, your point is that the standard of proof,
right,
clear and convincing versus beyond a reasonable doubt, was wrong.
That's correct.
Because you make the argument that some of those questions are really the same as the federal questions.
No, that's right. I think both the county and the Court of Appeals have used an analysis that highlights just how functionally equivalent they are.
Does that mean we have to modify, reverse, overturn, reinterpret any case?
DSP is distinguishable. In that case, the issue was abandonment. And this court said in that case that it was okay to apply additional safeguards. Well, in this case, because both the federal and the state law are addressed to the same issue, which is continuing neglect, you can't have additional safeguards. All the state law did was water down the standards of the federal law.
Still at the burden of proof, though.
What's that?
Your basic argument here is burden of proof.
That's correct. And if you disagree with me, I can live with that. But
what does it do with your client?
Well,
does it disagree with you?
Well, I think my client would still get a new trial.
Why?
Because this is a trial of any of the elements at the wrong standard is structural error, or at least should be presumed prejudicial.
Finally, let me just ask this.
Yes, sir.
Was there any error in the instructions with respect to the federal questions?
I haven't highlighted any.
And did the court apply the higher standard of proof with respect to the federal questions?
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Well, if that is the case, and the higher standard was applied with respect to the federal questions, and if your argument is that the state questions are essentially the same as the federal questions, why doesn't that solve the problem? Wouldn't this be harmless error?
You're right. You're asking a harmless error question. And I think that the cases that I cite in my brief that address structural error are the best answer I can give to that. And that is that, we can't know what happened. And when you try a case at the wrong standard of proof, any of the elements at the wrong standard of proof, you can't know what happened. In this case, there's additional reason to be concerned because the court instructed the jury on the lower burden of proof first and the lower issues, and then told them to decide the federal issue. Well, it's entirely possible that they went through and said, okay, we've answered this under the state burden, let's now answer the federal burden, and they may have said, didn't we just answer this? They're the same question. Yes, but they're the different burden of proof. And we cannot know why they reached the verdict they did. And that's why structural error must apply.
Hasn't the United States Supreme Court and hasn't this Court said that with respect to errors, certain errors in jury instructions, it's not structural error, but subject to the harmless error test?
Well, that's entirely true. But, I mean, and this Court is in disagreement over exactly what harmless error test applies. But I think even if you apply the Nader test, that this would qualify as error.
Well, because you're not arguing necessarily that the instruction wording was wrong about the elements to be proved. You're arguing that it's the burden of proof instruction that was wrong, and that was not the issue in Nader, not the issue in Harvey, but in the issue of other cases that you said. So what's your emphasis here?
Well, the emphasis is on the burden of proof, and because this would have been a very different case if the jury had been told from the beginning, you must find this evidence beyond a reasonable doubt. And they weren't. They were told from the very beginning, part of this case is clear and convincing evidence. I'd just like to briefly talk about the sufficiency of the evidence. None of the evidence in this case supports a claim that continued custody in Shannon's care would result in serious or emotional or physical damage. In DSP, this Court said that whether the evidence supports a requirement of the ICWA is a question of law. However, because this question of law is intertwined with factual issues, we give the Circuit Court's decision on this issue some way. No matter what standard you apply, though, the evidence was insufficient. The best the state could do was to have the qualified experts say that there were latent consequences that could show up later in life. That's not good enough. It requires that the county prove that no termination of parental rights may be ordered in such proceeding in the absence of a determination supported by evidence beyond a reasonable doubt, including testimony of a qualified expert witness, that the continued custody of the child by the parent or Indian custodian is likely to result in serious emotional or physical damage to the child. There simply was no testimony of serious emotional or physical damage to the child.
Counselor, why isn't it sufficient to bring forth the death of the sister that caused the removal of the younger child at birth?
It wasn't brought forth here. It was never presented to the jury. So there was no evidence presented on that to the jury.
So the jury never heard that they were taken out of their home and placed in county foster care because another child died in the care of the mother.
That's correct. So that simply wasn't part of the evidence here.
She had problems, didn't she? She didn't have a permanent home or stable home, didn't have a permanent or stable job, had various run-ins with the criminal justice system, didn't meet her schedule for visiting with the child. As I read the summaries of the record, half of the time she did, the other half she didn't. There were difficulties here.
It's very true. Everything you say is very true. But the Bureau of Indian Affairs guidelines make it very clear that evidence of instability, poverty, inadequate housing, alcohol abuse, nonconforming behavior does not constitute clear and convincing evidence that continued custody is likely to result in serious emotional or physical damage to the child. That's the lower standard for placing a child into foster care. If that doesn't qualify to place a child into foster care, then it certainly cannot qualify to terminate a parent's rights.
Counselor, I have one last question. Okay. It's probably a curveball, so you can treat it as such. The dad was the one who was a tribal member. And he consented to the termination of his parental rights for these children. And it's the mom that's raising these arguments, but she's not a tribal member.
That's correct.
Is there any reason for us to think that ICWA ought not to apply to her rights to these children, even though it certainly would apply to his rights?
It's been conceded throughout this entire thing that ICWA does apply, and I think under 4801 that is very clear that as long as the child is the has a parent who is an Indian and is eligible for enrollment in a tribe, then ICWA applies.
Even to the non-Indian parent?
That's,
I understand it's not been argued. That's
right.
Why I said it was
in this case will affect a lot of parents who are Indians. So.
No, I understand that as well. Okay.
Because ICWA protects the child, not the parent.
Yes, that's correct.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Finley. Is it Mr. Paquette? Christopher C. Paquette, Assistant Corporation Counsel of Brown County, representing the Brown County.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Christopher Paquette, and I represent Brown County, the petitioner respondent in this matter. The first issue that was raised by the respondent appellant counsel is the issue of the loss of competency. The county would refute the argument made by counsel with four separate arguments. First, that there is undisputed facts that four hearings were held on the petition, on the consolidation petition, and regarding both children within 30 days of September 2nd of 2003, which was the date of filing of the petition. It will be the county's position, first and foremost, that each one of those constitutes a hearing necessary to fulfill the requirements set forth in Chapter 48. Only the October 23rd of 2003 hearing was the completion of the initial appearance. And therefore, we feel that the initial appearance was held within the 30 days. If the court were to reject
that... Because you view this as told under the statute. Under what provision? G?
Well, actually, it would be... The first argument submitted by the county is that the tolling begins when the bodies come into the courtroom. That initiates the initial appearance starting. Whether or not it is completed on that particular day...
What day is that here?
I believe that was September 4th of 2003, was the first hearing on consolidation.
Okay.
So before we even get to a reason for a continuance, the county would submit that that begins, that happens clearly within the 30 days, and that commences the initial appearance.
So you're now starting in September 4th, is that
September
it?
September 4th, okay. We just don't complete the initial appearance until October 23rd of 2003, at which time the matter was assigned to Judge McKay.
What are you supposed to do with the initial appearance?
Ideally, you would have a plea. More often than not, the parent is unrepresented. In this particular case, because of the prior occurrences, the prior petition, the mother was represented. More often than not, the parent comes in at the initial appearance and simply makes a request for an attorney.
Is there any significance to the fact that Shannon was not there on October 23rd?
Because she had been represented by counsel, and I think there is significance insofar as that implies that she understood that her initial appearance had already occurred and this was just the completion of the initial appearance.
Well, isn't it somewhat troubling, at least it's troubling to me, to argue that somehow or other what occurred on October 23 was the completion of the initial appearance when she wasn't there?
I think that is problematic, and that would, in my opinion, support my argument that this was an initial appearance that actually took five hearings to complete. Sometimes Shannon appeared and sometimes she did not. As the record reflects, this matter was heard before Judge Bischel, then it was placed before Judge Dietz, then Judge Dietz placed it back before Judge Bischel, Judge Bischel placed it back before Judge Dietz, and at that point Judge Dietz said, I can't hear this matter, and sent it to the district court administrator. So the county's first position will be on a factual basis that we never lost our 30 days because the initial appearance did, in fact, commence within the 30-day period of time.
If I could, the county never really responded to the first argument in the brief. I know that Mr. Finley didn't argue regarding the notice issue and whether or not there had been adequate notice to Shannon. As I understood the notice, it was sent care of Melissa Marcus at an address that apparently Ms. Shannon R. no longer lived at. Isn't that correct?
That was not my understanding of the facts, that was the last known address of Ms. Rupar, or I'm sorry, Shannon R., and she did not, she never provided any forwarding address thereafter. It is the position of the county that the appellant respondent's argument is in fact an argument that personal service, or at least an affirmative obligation by the county, is present to prove that she received them. I think the evidence brought out at trial proves that she did. She, on numerous occasions, indicated that she was well aware of what would happen.
But didn't counsel object initially towards the regarding the service issue, and isn't it true she didn't attend that first proceeding? So how did she submit?
She did not attend the first proceeding. I do believe she was at the dispositional hearing.
Right, but she wasn't at the first proceeding. So at that point, how did she submit to the jurisdiction of the court?
She was personally served with a copy of the petition for termination of parental rights. The argument made by adverse counsel is that she never received a copy of the termination of parental rights warnings that must be attached to a dispositional order. So she wasn't
the warnings that she has to ameliorate the condition.
A copy of the dispositional order was mailed to her. That's what the second party signed for as received.
Counsel, getting back to what you were advancing before Justice Butler's question, the problem I have with your proposition is that it sounds like a judge can start an initial appearance, let me pick a date, on September 27th and continue it until April 4th. You think that's what it was intended?
No, I do not. I do not believe that meets the requirement for reasonableness. There is inherently an argument for reasonable delay in any continuance, whether or not such continuance, the actual period of time of delay is reasonable. That would not, in my opinion, be reasonable. I make my argument based on the commonality of initial appearances normally commence and rarely are completed on the day that they commence in a termination of parental rights case.
Certainly. And then what happens is the court goes on the record under 48.315(2) and states good cause for extending the time period, right?
Right.
That didn't happen here. There was no on-the-record discussion for good cause of extending, was there?
There was no direct incantation of that good cause finding. I do not feel that the judge does not have to per se say, I make a finding of good cause. I believe the implied facts of what occurred. That goes into the county's second position that if we do not accept this as a continuation of the initial appearance that took five hearings to complete, we do feel that the county would propose that the disqualification standard does apply to Judge Dietz's actions, indicating that he could not hear this within a reasonable period of time, and therefore he was sending it to the district court administrators. I have read Section 757.19 and would submit to the court that that indicates when a judge must recuse himself or disqualify him or herself. It does not indicate whether or not that judge may at any other time recuse him or herself.
Counselor, what were the changes in time, even though he didn't use the magic words good cause, were the adjournments done on the record?
I believe every continuance that occurred, every hearing that occurred between September 4th and October 23rd of 2003 was held on the record. I believe each one of those was.
Let me get to what you were just arguing a few minutes ago about congestion and how congestion is sufficient to meet the requirements of the statute. That troubles me also, and I'll tell you why. It seems to me that there can be some real abuse in regard to the time limits set by the legislature in Chapter 48 if we allow the idea of congestion to interfere with these definite time limits. It strikes me that all kinds of games can be played with the idea of congestion. How do you respond to that?
I would respond with the April O case, I do believe, affords such protection to prevent that. It requires that prior to the expiration of that 30 days, the court must go on the record and make a finding of good cause, not necessarily with a direct incantation of good cause, but find facts sufficient to order the continuance, which is subject to scrutiny on the appellate level if necessary. And therefore, I believe the April O decision, which indicates that finding must be on the record and it must occur prior to the 30 days, protects adequately the parties involved in this matter in order to prevent such unnecessary or unreasonable
delays. But that didn't happen here. I mean, I'm not a stickler for saying, okay, I'm convening this proceeding. I do hereby deem that there is good cause. And that's not what I'm looking for. No one needs magic words, but you need some kind of rationale articulated as to why you're holding the matter over. Did that happen here?
I believe it did, both to the 48315 sub 1 sub C and sub G level. I believe Judge Bischel indicated on the record that this matter is to be consolidated. I'm ordering it, but I'm sending it over to Judge Dietz, and he can figure.
Okay, that's consolidation. So, I mean, that's not what you're talking about in terms of congestion. That's something very separate.
Well,
that's sub G.
Then that would be to the sub G. To the sub C, if you will, or to the just general sua sponte court congestion issue, I would indicate that Judge Dietz said, I do not have time. As you all know, I can't remember the exact words. I have 5 contested termination of parental rights cases coming up. I cannot reasonably have this trial within the time frame. I'm sending it to the district court administrator. That's a clear articulation of good cause.
And that was on the record?
That was on the record.
Well, here's the problem. The legislature has set forth in numerous statutes the following cases go to the head of the line. So the head of the line is just huge. In other statutes, such as the ones we're dealing with, the legislature has put in time periods. And the legislature did it for a reason, namely, if this child's status is going to be changed and there'd be a termination of parental rights, it should be done very promptly in the child's life because it's easier to get an adoptive situation and easier to handle the child and better for the child to do that. And it's only fair to the parents to move this along. The federal statutes, not only IGWA, but the adoption statutes, require that things move along. And the state will be penalized if we don't move these proceedings along. So that's the legislative framework and the social policy, which is time matters more for children than for people of our age, as varied as our ages are. All right. Then you get the court system. We have excellent judges in Brown County. We have an excellent district court administrator in Brown County, and they have congestion problems. But, and here's the problem we face, this child was shunted for how many judges?
3.
3 judges over a period of time that exceeded, if you don't count the tolling, the amount of time that the legislature suggests. So what do we do, and how do we, and this really is Justice Crooks's question expressed somewhat differently, how does a court sitting here understand the problems of an excellent trial bench and congestion and yet see that these children are not delayed, and that it is taken care of, I mean, all for court purposes instantly. I mean, 30 days for a court is nothing, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Cases last for years.
I would submit that 48315 sub 1 is exactly the legislative, the intent of that is to provide for such continuances and good cause.
I know, but it doesn't talk about congestion like the Juvenile Justice Code does.
But I think it's impossible for a statute that talks about reasons for continuation to articulate every single reason. You would have, if the judge's car broke down that particular day, if the court reporter was sick, there's innumerable reasons for good cause that are not found specifically articulated.
But, Mr. Paquette, isn't the whole point of Judge Dietz sending it to the district court administrator so that the hearing can be held within the 30-day time period. Otherwise, he could just say, I've got this congestion, I'm going to adjourn it past the 30 days. The whole point of sending it to the administrator was to get it within the 30 days, right?
I believe his greater concern was to have the trial, the adjudication portion of the trial, the fact-finding portion of the trial, held within the 45 days. There was never a discussion at that time about whether or not the initial appearance was held within the 30 days. I don't want to speak for Ms. Schmieder whether or not that was presumed or not. I myself made that presumption that we were okay for the initial appearance. We were more worried about having the fact-finding hearing within the statutorily prescribed 45 days. So that's, in my impression, why Judge Dean sent it to the District Court Administrator.
The argument is that the 45 days doesn't start until after the initial appearance is completed.
Correct.
So it's... All right.
If I take a look at the argument submitted regarding the Indian Child Welfare Act and its application to the state law here, the county would dispute Attorney Finley's argument. We would concur that this matter is distinguished from the DSP finding only insofar as the grounds that existed for the termination of parental rights. That is the only distinction that can be drawn. DSP was an abandonment case. This is a continuing need case. The state standard remains consistent. There are innumerable state standards available for the termination of parental rights. None of them, the county would submit, is an inherent conflict with the Indian Child Welfare Act. Albeit this one exceptionally similar to the grounds, the Indian Child Welfare Act is not intended to arbitrarily make it more difficult.
Counsel, let me, if I might interrupt for just a minute. Do you concede that the questions 2 and 4 and 5 and 6 on the special verdict are basically the equivalent of each other? That the argument is, as I understand your opposing counsel, that, you know, you're really asking the jury the same thing. Now, when I look at those questions, I see some differences in terms of wording. Do you think they're essentially equivalent anyway?
I think that they have some differences in regards to the standards that they hold the petitioner to. I would concur with Attorney Finley that we speak about substantial or active efforts versus reasonable efforts. I believe those are two different things. I believe that the additional provision requiring the prevention of the breakup of a Native American family is significantly different than failing within 1 year. That's a time limit, that's specific, and there's also different standards applied to preventing the breakup of a Native American family and whether or not conditions are met. So I do believe there are some distinctions.
Counsel, taking off what my learned colleague, Justice Prosser, said earlier, that was a plug for you, Justice President.
Are we supposed to applaud?
Well,
get his vote. Go ahead.
Dying to hear the question.
Yeah, okay. Take a look at 48.315, pre-hearing tolling, that is sub A.
Yes.
Okay. In this case, with regard, and that's what Justice Prosser was focusing on earlier in his comments. So we have here Brown County filed Darrell's petition on September 2nd. 2 days later, it filed a motion to consolidate. My question is a motion to consolidate a pre-hearing motion as contemplated in 48.315A.
I definitely believe that it is.
Well, let's say that it is. And so if you look at that, then you've got the motion that was filed on September 4th. The time, arguably, for hearing that motion went from September 4th until we had several hearings, but no decision was made, September 26th, when the judge granted the consolidation motion. I'm just saying, arguably, then the period is told for purposes of this pre-hearing motion that was filed on September 4th and decided on September 26th, although there were other
hearings in between. I mean, they were trying to get this done on the 12th and the 18th. There were hearings, apparently. So the decision was made on the 26th. Arguably, the time toll starts running again on the 26th. And as I believe, then we had initially October 23rd, which would have been within that 30-day limit. But unfortunately, Shannon was not able to attend that initial appearance, which again, under 48315 F, I guess it is, allows for tolling for the unavailability of the child or the mother, as I see it. And so then you've got tolled until for that ostensibly for a few more days until you have your initial appearance on the 27th. You didn't argue that.
I did not, Your Honor, and that's I believe that's completely consistent with my initial argument. One of the reasons I didn't argue that is because I don't know if I can come before this court and definitively say that is what occurred. There was some frustration regarding what was going on between these two branches, if I may speak very frankly, with having a hearing week after week and nobody wanting to definitively say, I am making a ruling on consolidation at this point. So my argument initially that I would propose to you is that it was a continuation of the initial appearance. And that would be the argument I would propose, although I would agree with your interpretation that that subsection could also apply as the petition for consolidation wasn't completed until September 26th.
Was it unreasonable time between September 4th and September 26th? The timeline that I have is that the petition was filed on September 4th. There was a hearing on the 12th. There was a hearing on the 18th. A continued hearing and finally a decision made on the 26th. Is there something in the record that reflects that this is an unreasonable period of time for this consolidation motion?
I believe that it is absolutely reasonable, especially particularly considering the amount of hearings that were held in that period of time. We were before the court repetitively.
Well, did you have new evidence presented?
It wasn't.
Where did you all show up and then the judge said, I'm not making a decision today?
Quite frankly, that's exactly what happened.
And that's what it looks like. I have not read the record. But the fact that you got three judges, that's the number you agreed, and you got, what is it, 3 weeks almost. Or a little, it is 3 weeks.
Yes.
Where it seems on the outside, and things always look easier on the outside than on the inside. I recognize that. It just seems that you got two kids, they live together, you ought to deal with these cases the same and consolidate them. Save a lot of court time, a lot of everybody else's time. At 3 weeks elapse, no decision is made, shunted from one judge to the other. And as I say, I understand the congestion, and I think these judges are all excellent, but there's a problem in here. And what do we do about it? What do you suggest? What kind of opinion should this court write?
I believe that the time frame was reasonable and due process requirements were met by the very nature that this matter was heard on the record repetitively. This isn't a case where a court held up their hands and said, I'm not making a decision on this court congestion, and we had to wait an exceptionally long period of time between the hearings. I believe the circuit court facilitated this issue as quickly as was practically possible. We had repetitive hearings on this.
Can you call it a hearing? Or did the judge just appear in open court and continue it?
I believe there was a hearing. There was an opportunity for Ms. Schneider to present any information regarding the consolidation. One of the issues was Ms. Schneider's client being somewhat unavailable and her and Ms. Schmieder not being able to ascertain whether or not she would consent to the consolidation. There was a question at the filing of the petition for consolidation whether or not we would have to have an actual evidentiary hearing on whether or not consolidation was going to be necessary.
So you're saying it was really the mother's fault?
I wouldn't place blame on the mother because of the nature of the notices that were coming. Those come relatively quickly. It's very easy for two attorneys who are across the street from the courtroom to show up at a moment's notice, but I think there was a communication problem.
Counsel, as you know, at the end of last term, we issued an opinion in a case with Matthew S. and Rachel B. Do you see any relevance to the decision that this court made in that case and what we're facing here?
I do not. I believe that the competency issue remains not unique to this court, but I think, again, distinguishing that even further, going to the prior determinations made by this court, we have the court retaining jurisdiction and having hearings within the statutorily prescribed time frame.
What was accomplished at the initial appearance for Darrell? The mother has had an initial appearance with respect to Daniel, and that was timely.
Correct.
Okay, so what is it possible that the court thought that basically everything that would be accomplished at an initial appearance had already been accomplished?
I cannot presume what the court thought. That is exactly what I thought, that we had an initial appearance. There was on the October 23rd hearing, there was a demand for a jury trial entered on the record, a colloquy administered regarding right to substitution. At that point, that issue had basically been resolved, that there was not going to be a request for substitution. And so that was what I would argue is the completion of the initial appearance. That's what was accomplished. But she already was aware of her right to an attorney. She already had retained counsel. Ms. Schmieder did, I believe, submit her retainer agreement prior, almost immediately upon filing of the petition. So from a practical standpoint of what normally happens at the initial appearance, all of that had already been done. She had already submitted a jury demand on the Daniel case, and therefore she was... I think it would be reasonable for the court to interpret that she was aware of what her rights were and what the intent of the initial appearance had already been accomplished.
Could I ask one other question on this judicial disqualification matter? The statute 757 something or other talks about shall, so it's sort of a mandatory. And you're holding out the concept of a permissive disqualification, I guess.
Yes.
Now, what is the basis for that argument?
Well, the basis for that argument is if I look at 757.19, it gives clear indication of a factual basis why a judge must disqualify themselves. I can envision other reasons why there would need to be a disqualification, poor health on an instantaneous basis, unavailability due to a family emergency. I believe that recusal, disqualification, all recusals are disqualifications, but all disqualifications are not inherently voluntary. That indicates when it would be, if you will, an involuntary disqualification, but a judge has the discretion to disqualify himself. I just would like to touch briefly on the sufficiency of evidence question, and as submitted by adverse counsel, he indicates that there is no evidence submitted regarding direct dangerousness. I think that's an elemental nature which is unnecessary in a termination of parental rights case, and what I mean by that is that this is not a criminal matter, that there has to be certain pieces of evidence. The entirety of the record, I believe, establishes that if these children were returned, they would be in substantial risk of serious physical or emotional harm. In order to pursue a continuing need case, it is necessary for a court to make a finding of the child to be in need of protection and services. They place dispositional conditions on the parent, and those dispositional conditions must be met for the child to be safely returned to the home. Absent those conditions being met, which there is no dispute that those conditions were not met. Maybe some were and some weren't. But absent that, I believe a jury can make a reasonable inference that if she does not complete her conditions, the children cannot safely be returned to the home. I do not believe it requires me to point to a specific piece of evidence. The social workers both testified, a probation agent testified, a parenting counselor testified, as well as the subject or the respondent herself, all testified, and she and the jury took the entirety of that evidence which was presented and made the inference that if these children were returned to the home, they would be in substantial risk of serious physical or emotional harm.
How do we know that's what the jury did?
I don't know what the jury did, but I think that there's a presumption that a jury can understand the instructions that are given, and that is the instruction that is given, and they answered that question to the affirmative, and they were instructed that if you cannot find evidence beyond a reasonable doubt to do this, you should answer that question negatively. But they did not do that. They answered that question affirmatively.
Counsel, do you think the right ruling was made by the circuit judge here in regard to Dr. Wellens and not permitting Dr. Wellens to testify as to whether or not Shannon could meet the conditions within the year period?
I believe that Judge McKay's rationale is articulated in the record and was correct. He never indicated that Dr. Wellens could not testify to whether or not there were any psychological bars to Shannon completing her conditions. He simply indicated when the question was asked, can she complete this within a year, he indicated that that was outside the scope of that particular expert's testimony.
And yet the other two so-called experts were able to express that opinion, right? That she couldn't meet the conditions within the year?
And Judge McKay ruled that because of the nature of a social worker who had worked with her over a period of 2 years, because of their experience within the field of child dispositional services, that they could opine as to the ability for a parent to meet that condition to a reasonable degree of professional certainty. I believe that Judge McKay's limitation on Dr. Wellens was only limiting him to an opinion to a reasonable degree of psychological certainty and needed to be placed in such a context that he could not speak to a factual yes or no answer. He could only indicate whether or not it was possible for her based on her psychological limitations, if there be any.
Now, as I understand it, you should correct me if I'm wrong, these social workers were not experts under ICWA. Not recognized as such. That's okay that they can testify, but...
I would indicate that the Indian Child Welfare Act provides a very broad spectrum of what constitutes an expert under the Indian Child Welfare Act. However, they were never submitted to the court as such.
Okay, so the state had one expert.
That's correct.
And like a doctor, and that expert had never seen the child either, or children, right?
No, he did not conduct
He did a record. And what was the question that was asked of him and to which he responded, upon which the jury could base a verdict?
He indicated that the county had complied with the Indian Child Welfare Act as he understood it, and he did answer to the affirmative that he did not feel she would be able to meet her conditions within a period of 1 year.
To a reasonable degree of medical certainty.
To a reasonable degree of professional certainty, he was not a doctor.
He's a professor at a university, isn't he?
He was a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point.
Had he met with Shannon?
He had never had any face-to-face contact with Shannon or the children.
So now
Dr. Wellens.
Did Dr. Wellens have face-to-face? Yes, he did. He conducted, I believe, 2 interviews, 1 with the children, 1 with the mother.
Then he had Judge Smart.
Correct.
Did he meet with the people?
He did not.
Testified for the state, and there was a question. He was a tribal judge, and the tribe here did not object to termination, as I understand it.
That is correct.
Okay. Are there any further questions?
Thank
you. Hearing none, thank you, Mr. Paquette. Mr. Finley?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm just going to address a few quick questions and then get on to the expert issue. Wisconsin Statute 48.422 sub 1 says, the hearing on the petition to terminate parental rights shall be held within 30 days after the petition is filed. At the hearing on the petition to terminate parental rights, the court shall determine whether any party wishes to contest the petition and inform the parties of their rights under sub 4 and 48.423. That did not occur in this case until October 23rd. When Judge Bischel joined the cases and referred them to Judge McKay, she explicitly held open the time limits and said, he'll have to deal with that. What we had here was three courts passing this case around, and it didn't get answered within 30 days. There was no initial appearance within 30 days.
Mr. Finley, apparently you're conceding that what occurred on October 23rd was indeed the completion of the initial appearance?
It was not the completion of the initial appearance. My notes show that the judge said that I will schedule this matter for the balance of the initial appearance, which is what we had today. The earliest you can say that the initial appearance occurred was October 23rd. In fact, it was completed considerably after that.
Do you think it's important whether or not Shannon was present at the initial appearance?
Well, she couldn't be informed of her rights, although this is a civil case and she could appear by counsel.
Does the statute say you can tell counsel, you don't have to tell the respondent?
It doesn't say that, no. But I do not, you know, I'd have to go back and look at the language the court used at the time to determine whether or not there was a valid continuance granted in open court. And I'm not sure that happened in this case. With respect to the disqualification issue, I'd just like to point out that there's absolutely no statutory authority the county can point to for its interpretation. With respect to the expert issue, this is really one of fundamental fairness. All of the county's experts got to give their opinion. And Dr. Wellens, who was arguably the best qualified witness in this case, wasn't allowed to present his testimony.
Exactly what was it, Counselor, that he wanted to give an opinion?
He wanted to give his opinion that Shannon would be likely to meet the conditions for return within 1 year.
Okay, so
he was allowed to testify that he saw nothing psychological that would keep her from
prevent her from doing it.
Right.
I see. Okay. Thank you.
But what the jury heard was all of the experts said she wouldn't be able to meet the conditions for return. Nobody said anything else otherwise. And that's fundamentally unfair. I think the analogy to the criminal law is necessary here. In State versus Mayday, the Court of Appeals said that it's fundamentally unfair. This court has cited that case with approval. You need a balanced, a level playing field, and there simply wasn't one here. The county has said that it was correct to deny Dr. Rollins from testifying. I think it was that is wrong. His testimony should have been admissible under any standard of the relevant law. His testimony was relevant. It went to an element. He was qualified as an expert. The judge qualified him as an ICWA expert, and he had done a psychological evaluation. He'd read the entire file. I don't know what more he could have done to qualify as an expert in this case. And three, the evidence assists the trier of fact in determining the issue of fact. This state is not a Daubert case, but even if it were, his testimony would be relevant under the Daubert standard. It is both relevant and reliable. It was an error to exclude. Furthermore, it was fundamentally fair, and I think if you do the balancing test of Matthews versus Eldridge, there's no reason that, as in Mayday, the parent should not be allowed to present her side of the story. We talked a little bit about the social workers in this case. I'd just like to point out that the social workers for the county were nothing like the social workers in DSP. In DSP, Francis Coco was a full-blooded Chippewa who had raised three Indian kids in the Indian tradition.
Martha Snyder was a member of the tribe and had reared 8 kids in the Indian tradition. She was one of the co-founders of the first Indian child placement agencies and one of the drafters of ICWA. In this case, only one of the social workers said that she had any testified that she had experience working with Indian children.
Okay. Question.
Justice Bradley?
You heard my inquiry to your opposing counsel with regard to the 48315 sub A, the tolling of the time period for pre-hearing motion. Can you give me a response to that?
Well, I don't think that the delay was reasonable here. I mean, I think that what was happening was the courts were arguing over who, as the county has said, the courts were arguing over who had responsibility for this case. And they certainly could have decided this issue much faster. My position is that even though there was a motion for joinder pending, that does not toll the time limits.
Why is that not a pre-hearing motion?
Well, because it's specifically listed, the more specific statute applies, and that's a motion for a joinder. So the legislature has specifically looked at joinder and said that they... That doesn't delay.
Well, it would seem to me that a motion to consolidate is a pre-hearing motion. So I'm missing something then.
Okay, but there was no reason why they couldn't have done the initial appearance.
So your response is that it was
a
pre-hearing motion, but the length of time between the time that it was filed and the time that it was decided, that is September 4th to the 26th, is an unreasonable period of
time.
That's
right. They could have decided this earlier. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Finley. Thank you, Mr. Finley, and thank you, Mr. Paquette, for your arguments this morning on yet another competence case involving juveniles as well as other issues. The court is in recess until tomorrow at 9:45 when we'll begin to hear 3 cases. Justice Robensack will be out to talk to the school youngsters, and the court will meet again in closed conference at 20 of 11 if we can.